Welcome back.
We are going to be doing nutrients and herbs. We've already talked about the biochemistry. We've talked about the anatomy. We've talked about what kind of things can go wrong in the conversions between hormones. Now we're going to get into the vitamins and minerals and other nutrients that you can use to protect yourself. And then we're going to get into some protocols for some specific things that can and do go wrong that your clients may be presenting with that you'll be able to help them with when you understand what really is going on. Let me just remind you that the information in this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's also not medical advice. It's just a sharing from my knowledge and information that I've gathered over the years, research I've done, clinical experience I've had with thousands of patients. It's my sharing to you. And what I recommend that you do is really research, look at your own body. If you're under the care of a medical practitioner, be sure to bounce these ideas off of them before you make major changes to your diet and lifestyle. So let's begin. So you've heard of hamburger helper. We've got hormone helpers. And the hormone helpers are the nutrients that are helpful for maintaining the metabolism of hormones and keeping them in the safe zone and keeping them optimally functioning and avoiding inhibition at the receptor sites and avoiding the wrong versions of them getting sent out and inhibiting the actual real function. So these nutrients have a lot of different functions. We've also already talked about the macronutrients, the protein, the carbohydrates, the fats, and the fiber. Now we're going to move into the vitamins, and then we'll move into the minerals, and then we'll hit some of the miscellaneous nutrients. Some of the miscellaneous nutrients we've already looked at, the indole 3 carbinol, the DIM, the sulforaphane, and the lignans, and the isoflavones, and some of the bioflavonoids, and we're going to look at some of the others as well. So this whole process of hormone balance requires a number of steps. Number one, the hormone gets synthesized. And it gets synthesized in the face of needing it. There's certain baseline levels of hormones that we need to maintain. The steroid hormones that we are discussing here, they have precursors, which are steroids, which are similar to the adrenals. So we've looked at those precursors, and we've looked at the fact that we need to have the correct precursors, raw materials, in order to make them. Once we make the hormones, in order for them to be active, they have to be able to bind to receptor sites. They also need to be able to be broken down, hydrolyzed, conjugated, and eliminated. And they also need to be in the right ratios to each other to have proper functioning. So there's a lot of moving parts here. So what we want to be able to do, and a lot of the problems come from, is not being able to excrete the hormones that have already been metabolized. Getting them, those hormones conjugated and eliminated is a real big problem for a lot of people. It's a very common problem. So we want to look at how can you speed up the excretion of metabolized hormones. So there's some things you want to be looking at when you have a person in front of you in terms of what's going on in their life, what's going on in their intake that you can optimize so that you can start to at least get rid of the already metabolized hormones. Because what happens is they've metabolized the hormones and they're at intermediate states. Some of them are pretty dangerous and damaging. If they don't get eliminated, for example, if they go down into the intestine, they're in the bile, and the person does not have appropriate bowel function, they're not eliminating, the toxins can be and I'm calling them toxins loosely because they are toxins because they're no longer helpful for the body. They can be reabsorbed, sent back to the liver, and get back into the bloodstream. We don't want that. So the steps involved to get rid of them faster would be to improve the transit time, meaning the time from mouth to anus in the digestive tract, to restore the balance of the friendly and unfriendly bacteria. And we know how to do that. Go back to the digestive tract for that. Increasing the metabolic rate, which will increase the rate of respiration and sweating, and that will help to eliminate these metabolic wastes. So exercise is a good thing. Also, other things like saunas are good things. Optimizing the hormone ratios And when you optimize the hormone ratios, that has to do with a lot of the factors that we looked at before, the estrogen to progesterone to testosterone, which means getting rid of some of the disruptors, the antagonists. We'll be looking a little bit more at the antagonists in this section related to environment. Improving liver detoxification, right? This is a phase one, phase two. We have to look at phase one, look at phase two. Phase one is hydroxylation. Easy pathway. Most people do it really efficiently, and then they get the hydroxy forms of the various hormones. Then we have to go through phase two, which involves, for the hormones, methylation primarily, sulfation, and glucuronidation. Those require having really good status of the nutrients needed, the sulfur, methyl, and antioxidants like glutathione. Okay, so that's how we improve the liver detoxification. You can use other liver detoxification kinds of formulas, and we talked about that in the detoxification module. Methyl donors, right? What are methyl donors? So, well, those are nutrients that have methyl before them. Methyl B12, methyl folate, SAMe, right? Those are all methyl donors. And there's TMG, trimethylglycine, DMG, dimethylglycine. Anything that has a methyl group, that's a CH3. Remember we saw all the hormones that had that little CH3? The CH3 attached to it, that's a methyl group. Anything that can donate that to the detoxification pathway to help to conjugate that to the hormones and then eliminate them. Sulfur-containing foods, garlic, onion, brassicas, other green leafy vegetables. Antioxidants, right? You can't actually take glutathione orally, although I had a conversation with another practitioner a few days ago, and he was talking about some new supplements that have come out that are a specific form of glutathione that's taken orally that I'm going to look into. He says that it looks like it's got really good promise. But antioxidants, like ways to improve glutathione, you know, NAC and some of the precursors, looking at superoxide dismutase and catalase and vitamin E and A and C, a lot of antioxidants. Plant-based flavonoids and things like that that are helpful as well. And then the nutrients. And we're going to get into the nutrients now to help you with the speeding up to optimize the nutritional function. And of course, turmeric. Yes, turmeric's amazing, right? You know, this is like not meant to be completely complete, but you did get turmeric in the detox. We talked a lot about that. So when you go back and improve the liver detoxification, you're going to pick up things like turmeric and dill and limonene and a lot of those other things. I have a whole page of nutrients that improve detox. So let's start with the vitamins. So the vitamins, like vitamin B6, actually, remember we talked about the ER beta and ER alpha and that the estrogens bind to those for different lengths of time and that the different estrogens have different preferences for whether they bind to alpha, beta, and for the length of time they bind. So vitamin B6 helps the estrogens to bind to the receptors for longer, especially to the beta form. Okay. So that's advantageous. So we can get the estrogens to bind for a longer period of time to the beta. We're going to extend the life and we're going to extend the benefits. So vitamin B6 is critical for that. If you have a deficiency in B6, you're not going to have as good a binding to the beta receptors. So if you're looking at B6, you're looking at, well, where can you get B6? But also, how do you avoid the things that interfere with the B6? So things that block B6 are pesticides and herbicides and plant growth regulators. They interfere with the production, the biochemistry of vitamin B6. Remember that when you take in nutrients, they're not necessarily in the form that your body uses, and your body has to metabolize them. So your body takes in vitamin B6, but it has to metabolize to the P5P form, the pyridoxal 5-phosphate form. So these herbicides and growth regulators can affect the ability of that conversion to happen and also block receptors. Found that FD&C yellow dye is an inhibitor of B6, as are PCBs, as is sugar, refined sugar, and also button mushrooms and alfalfa seeds. Although they're very mild inhibitors, they shouldn't be eaten in robust amounts on a regular basis. You could still have them, but not in large amounts. If people are eating like mushroom pate with alfalfa sprouts every day, it could be potentially disruptive of B6. So the B vitamins in general, we singled out B6 because it had, you know, more of a robust kind of a mechanism for how it worked. But the B vitamins in general, so B6 in addition, B6, B12, and folic acid are important for the conjugation and methylation. You know that if you have a deficiency of B6, folic acid, or B12, you get a buildup of homocysteine because you can't fully take the products through that whole methylation cycle. So B6, 12, and folic acid are important for estrogen conjugation and elimination. B6 deficiency makes the estrone and estradiol stay on the alpha receptors longer. Okay, so it increases, a sufficient B6 will make the estrogen stay on the beta receptors longer. A deficiency will make them stay on the alpha receptors longer. So what are some signs of B6 deficiency? These are signs that you'll be looking for with people. Chronic episodic fluid retention. And sometimes that can create fluid retention in the hands, and people who have a tendency towards overuse syndrome can end up with a carpal tunnel-like presentation from a history of B6 deficiency. Monitor severe PMS, because remember that B6 is also important for the conjugation and elimination of estrogen. So B6 and even magnesium deficiency, especially in the last 2 weeks of the cycle, in the luteal phase of the cycle, are especially important. So people who have PMS, you might start with putting them on some B6 or magnesium because it helps to conjugate the estrogens. Carpal tunnel syndrome, right? The pressure on the nerve root because of some fluid buildup. Some arthritises are B6 deficient. So if somebody has some arthritis, you may be thinking they have B6 deficiency. ADHD, depression, gestational diabetes, asthma, nausea and vomiting in pregnancy responds really well to vitamin B6. People who have chronic habitual abortions, repeated miscarriages, kidney stones, seborrheic dermatitis. In fact, people who have seborrheic dermatitis on their scalp and on their eyelashes, you can get a cream made with vitamin B6, like a compounding pharmacy can make that. And there may be even someone over the counter. And you can just rub that on those areas, and it helps to restore that B6 deficiency and get rid of the seborrheic dermatitis. Schizophrenia and any other kinds of neurotransmitter type imbalance can be signs of B6 deficiency, because B6 is so important as a cofactor for the conversion between the amino acids and their neurotransmitters. MSG intolerance can be related to B6, infertility, and poor dream recall. What I find is that when I put people on vitamin B6 for whatever reason, they'll tell me, wow, I just started remembering my dreams. I haven't remembered my dreams in years. Or sometimes I'll even ask that, do you tend to remember your dreams? Oh my God, no, I haven't remembered a dream in years. Put them on B6 and their dreams come back. I'm not sure exactly what the biochemistry of that is, but it's a rather interesting phenomenon. PABA, paraaminobenzoic acid, gently slows down the breakdown of your natural hormones so that those good hormones, before they're conjugated, before they're broken down, are lasting longer. Protects against ovarian cancer while it boosts your immune system. PABA can also be anti-inflammatory and antioxidant. It's part of the B-complex family. So we can look at, how do you get more B vitamins? Well, you look at the foods. And we have some charts in here. I'm not going to go over every single food on these charts. These are here for your reference. Foods that are high in folate, foods that are high in B-complex. So make sure that if you're suspicious of a B-complex problem, or if a person is having some estrogen metabolism type problems and signs of progesterone and estrogen imbalances, then this is a good thing to do. Get them on B vitamin rich foods, and you might also have to supplement them with a B vitamin. I like the activated forms of the B vitamins when you do resort to supplementation, because generally speaking, especially if the person's on a decent diet, they may be inadequate conversion to the activated form. So activated forms of Bs is the best way to go. And things like the Premier Research brand, I think that Pure Encapsulations has one, Thorn has them. So there's a number of companies that have the activated Bs in their formulations. Vitamin D, super important. Vitamin D distracts the enzymes that promote the bad pathways and lets estrogen scoot down to the safer 2-series pathway. So this is important. Vitamin D is so important in so many functions in the immune system and thyroid metabolism and leaky gut, leaky brain. It's really good for membrane integrity. really important that you're testing everybody for vitamin D and supplementing them when they need to. A lot of folks don't absorb their D real well because they may have a SNP that doesn't allow them to. They may have some other metabolic imbalances. They may have low vitamin K. So it's important when you're seeing a low vitamin D is that supplement first, figure out why it's happening, correct those things, get them out in the sun, and then see what they actually need to do moving forward. But it's really important to restore the balance there. So vitamin D also rescues the cytochrome P-series enzymes in liver detox and reduces the activation of the estrogen, 16 series, so 16-OH estrogens that are so deadly. Okay, so therefore it protects against breast, colon, and prostate cancer. Vitamin E. Low levels have been linked to excessive estrogen growth. There have been studies where it inhibits breast cancer growth. Deficiencies can decrease the cytochrome P function, the P450 and others, in the liver. So that decreases your estrogen detoxification. So remember, you go through phase one and you create the OH, the hydroxy versions, and then it's stuck because the cytochrome enzymes aren't working well. You may also have low cytochrome activity because of SNPs, because of some genetic alterations. So it's really important that you maintain high levels of the nutrients as high as they need to. Make sure, though, that when you're using vitamin E, you just don't let them go to Walgreens and pick up a vitamin E that's an alpha tocopherol. You want to have mixed tocopherols or as natural a source of vitamin E as possible. Vitamin C. This is an interesting statistic that mammals who make their own vitamin C can live to 8 to 10 times beyond their age of physical maturity. So say for us, for example, if we physically mature at age 18, that would mean that we can live to up to 180 years old. There's not very many people doing that potential. Why? Because we don't make our vitamin C. We lost that somehow. And we need to be making sure that we're getting enough vitamin C. And the RDA is not enough. I think they raised it from 60 milligrams to 100. A minimum dose that I recommend for anybody is 500 milligrams three times a day. Bowel tolerance, especially if they're sick. If they're fine, you know, all these things we're talking about apply to people who are not necessarily in optimal health. They're coming to you because they want to get to be optimal. They want to restore their hormone function. They want to restore their energy. So we got to look at bowel tolerance on vitamin C. And there's two ways to do it. You can do bowel tolerance by having them do the vitamin C flush where they devote a day to just constantly increasing their C dose until they get a watery evacuation like they gave themselves an enema. Then you back off from there and do 75%. It's all described on the site. Or you can do it a different way, and a lot of people prefer this way. You start them at a dose that you think is going to be reasonable. For most people, I would say 1,000 milligrams three times a day, unless they have a history of irritable bowel or they're a child, but 500 milligrams at the minimum three times a day, and then you have them gradually increase that until they get to the point where they have more than desirable numbers of bowel movements, looser than normal, more urgency, more gas, and then they back off. That's their bowel tolerance. And tell them that that's going to change as time goes on. They're not always going to stay at that same bowel tolerance. It's going to shift. It's going to change. So they have to be aware of that. But when you get them up to bowel tolerance, it makes the adrenals work more efficiently. It reduces the incidence of estrogen-induced mammary tumors. It increases the immune system. It helps to fight off chronic and hidden infections that they may not even know they have that are compromising their health. So really important. Any kind of vitamin C. I personally use the PERC, not ascorbate. Actually, it's a buffered ascorbate. So it's called PERC Potent C. And I've had really, really good results with that one. You can use a natural form of vitamin C, but it's a little bit harder to get to the bowel tolerance and know that it's bowel tolerance because of the C, because a lot of the natural forms have more fiber and other constituents in there. Find a good brand. It should be buffered, because if it's just pure ascorbate, it's going to be hard on your teeth. I would say I love the Health Force Nutritionals Natural Vitamin C. Some people can't take it because it's got some berries type stuff, and if you have really sensitive to sugars, personally, it makes my sugar go up a little bit. I could probably get away with a little bit of it in a green smoothie, but not on its own. And also it's harder to get there. So it depends on what's going on. Maintenance doses, it's great to use those. But if you're looking for a therapeutic effect and somebody who's been sick for a while and you're trying to help them get over it or they're out of balance, then I've had really good results with the PERC.
And I think it is from corn, unfortunately. Most of the C's are not from soy. They're mostly from corn. So again, here's just some more stuff for your reference library. You probably know all this already, but vitamin C and vitamin E sources, all those, you know, wonderful fruits and colorful vegetables, the rainbow vegetables like carrots and red bell pepper, cantaloupe, and then some other more therapeutic superfood type food sources like kamu and amla, your citrus and all those good sources of vitamin C. On the vitamin E side, you've got wheat germ oil. I don't use that often. Sprouts, nuts and seeds, whole grains. A lot of people can't tolerate the whole grains because of glycemic issues. Turnip greens, mango, dandelion greens, pistachio, spinach. Those are all good sources of vitamin E. You can also get tocotrienols, which are from rice bran. And that's more closer to the natural source. So it's kind of in between the food and the supplement itself, the isolated supplement. So that's it for vitamins. Let's look at minerals that are important for hormones. So minerals will help us activate the fatty acid cascade. Remember, delta-60 saturase has a number of mineral cofactors that are important for converting your short-chain fatty acids, the linoleic, into the long-chain EPA-DHA. Minerals also activate safe estrogen metabolism. Remember, as an example, iodine helps you to go from the 16-OH, which is toxic and carcinogenic, to estriol, which is super protective. Cofactors for enzymes that run the metabolic processes. Okay, so there's selenium and for the thyroid, and there's magnesium, which has like 100 different metabolic functions. Zinc, which has lots and lots of enzymatic reactions that it's a cofactor for. Minerals help us make use of energy. Remember the Krebs cycle. Going through that helps to protect receptors. Like remember, selenium helps to protect thyroid receptors and activates the favorable versus the unfavorable conversion. So minerals are really important when it comes to hormone balance. So let's take a look at some of the key ones. Iodine. Iodine is super, super important for the thyroid and the breasts and for estrogen metabolites. Iodine is so severely deficient in our society. Unless you live by the sea and eat from the sea, you probably don't get enough iodine. So when people are coming in, you got to ask them about that, about their eating habits. Most people at first blush are not sitting down to a huge bowl of kelp or arame as you might, because you've been aware of this for a long time. And that's where you come in to be able to teach them how delicious those things can be. So iodine comes from those foods that are really rarely eaten. Seafood is, but people don't eat a lot of seafood. A lot of people eat meat, but not a whole lot of fish. The iodine helps to take the proliferative 16-alpha hydroxy and bring it down to the estriol. And estriol is protective, remember? Estriol is that forgotten estrogen, the good guy estrogen or good girl estrogen. So iodine helps to do that conversion. And it helps to keep the estrogen quotient in that safe range. Remember, the estrogen quotient is E3, which is estriol, divided by the sum of E1 and E2, estradiol and estrone. And if that number is 1 or greater, it means that you got a good ratio going on. You're protected. If it's below 1, then it means that you've got work to do. And generally speaking, iodine is super, super valuable in helping this. I think I got this from Meridian Valley, but this is just an example of a person that had a low estrogen quotient. So if you see, her estrone was 19, her estradiol was 18, and her estriol is 27. This is an obviously premenopausal woman. Oftentimes, we see the total estrogens in the single digits in a postmenopausal. And you can see by looking at the numbers in the normal range, a premenopausal woman estrone anywhere from 3 to 52. This person's decent at 19. She's not too high. She's not in the highest end. The premenopausal on estradiol, 1 to 45, again, she's on a lower end, 18. Her premenopausal on estriol is 7 to 221. So she needs a boost in estriol. See, 27? She needs more of her estrone and estradiol to be converted into estriol to get that number up. While it's still within the quote-unquote normal range, when you look at the ratio of it with the estrone and estradiol, you come out with the estrogen quotient, meaning 27 divided by 19 plus 18 is going to be less than 1. It's 0.74. When you get this and you supplement with iodine, the numbers shift pretty dramatically. The issue is just finding how much iodine you need to use. You can complement this test, the estrogen quotient test, with an iodine loading test, and that way you know where they're at. Or you can use this as sort of your iodine indicator, right? Your indicator of how their iodine is doing and saying, well, given this number, they probably are low in iodine. The question is, how much do you supplement? Oftentimes, 12.5 milligrams of a combination of iodine and iodide will do the trick. And there's a supplement called Iodorol, which is a tablet, or you can get Lugol's solution. Lugol's comes in a 2% or a 3.4%, I believe. There's two different percentages of Lugol's. And I think that now the higher one, the higher percent one, is only available by prescription. What that means is you just have to do more drops. If you go on to Google and you research, it changes all the time, but I did research not that long ago and found some sources online for the Lugol's. It also tells you how many milligrams of iodine a drop of Lugol's would equal, and then you calculate that as to how much you want them to take. Generally speaking, anywhere from 12 to 50, depending on how low this number is. If I saw somebody with an estrogen quotient of less than 0.5, I'd probably put them on at least a couple of weeks of 50 just to bump their numbers up. Now, if I coupled that with an iodine load test that said that they were just borderline low, then I might be a little bit more cautious, especially if they have a history of Hashimoto's or other autoimmune disease, because excess iodine can trigger that. But adding iodine to somebody who's deficient, I don't believe in my good conscience that would trigger somebody to go into a Hashimoto's, because they're not deficient. Their body needs it. And the mechanisms by which the iodine is used in the body are going to be suffering, i.e. not making enough thyroid hormone, not converting enough thyroid hormone, and not converting estrogen appropriately. So it's really important that we do diligence and don't just go by, oh, somebody said that this is toxic, I'm therefore I'm going to deprive the person of it, because the deficiency of it can be just as damaging or more damaging than other. I tend to like to use liquids better than tablets just because you can titrate it more carefully. You can ramp somebody up. If you're working with somebody who's really sensitive, environmentally sensitive, and maybe it's because they have a whole bunch of SNPs that affect their detoxification, but in general, I like to go slow with people like that. So I'll just say, okay, take one drop, take two drops, take three drops. It's hard to do that when you have a tablet. Easier to do it with a capsule as long as it doesn't taste gross. You can have them open the capsule, take a little pinch, and then gradually increase it until they're taking the whole capsule. But I like to be going really slowly as I'm adding things to make sure that we're in the just right stage, that we're not overdoing it and we're not underdoing it as well. Okay. Some people tend to overprescribe, and that's not good. You get a lot of extra and you spend a lot of money or you pee it away. There's a lot of reasons for not doing it. But if you don't do enough, you're doing the person a disservice because they're not going to get the results. So that's it. All that because of the estrogen quotient. So iodine-rich foods, of course, we know the sea vegetables, kelp, dulse, alaria, arame, and fish. I made a very interesting, very iodine-rich meal. I took a cup of arame and I soaked it. And arame is really cool because you only have to soak it for 10 or 15 minutes and it softens up like little thin spaghetti noodles. Drained it off but saved the liquid. And then I put in a bowl and I made a sauce. And on the sauce, I put tahini and ginger, a pinch of toasted sesame oil just for the flavor. I put in a little bit of cayenne, and I put the soak water that I'd soaked the arame in, and some lemon. And I blended that up, and it was delicious. As I look back, I probably could have put in some garlic, and that would have given it some extra sulfur. I blended it up, and then I did something I've never done before. I put a teaspoon of cordyceps mushroom powder in there, which is a really great adrenal support. And then I actually took two bags of the konjac noodles, And I mixed them in with that because I would have just done one, but it just didn't seem like enough noodles. So I did that. Now, had I been not in a hurry, I would have probably chopped up some other things and put some scallions and maybe some red bell pepper or sesame seeds. There were a lot of things I could have done with it, but it was a really quick meal. I mean, literally took me less than 5 minutes to make. The plan was that I would eat half yesterday and half today. And it was so good that I ate the whole thing. So I got plenty of iodine in that meal, in addition to zinc and magnesium and all sorts of other nutrients that are loaded in the sea vegetables and the aramae. So be creative with it. It was really fun. It was really delicious. And it was like this big noodle dish, but it was meeting my nutritional needs. And then adding that extra, so you can always add extras. Think about what the person needs. And instead of giving them a whole bunch of supplements, think about how many of those things you can satisfy by getting some powdered herbs and adding that to their food. Rather than it being a whole separate ritual, they can just add it to their food. So give it a try and be creative. I know some of you just love to be in the kitchen, play with it. See what really robust things you can come up with to help your people get into balance. So let's move to magnesium. Magnesium, sometimes people call it liquid chlorophyll or the sunshine, chlorophyll and sunshine. It's like you're basically eating sunshine, right? And magnesium, it's a cofactor for lots of processes, over 300 processes. There's an MD that has a really nice blog. Her name is Carolyn Dean, and she's just devoted her whole entire research to magnesium. She's written a book on magnesium. Magnesium's amazing. I mean, we're only touching the surfaces on magnesium. I have her book and I keep meaning to read through it, but I just pick up a few things here and there on how important magnesium is. Magnesium also can be supplemented in a loading format the way you do vitamin C. And generally with magnesium, you start with a certain dose, maybe 200 milligrams three times a day, twice a day. And then you basically increase. Magnesium is not as important to do in multiple times throughout the day as vitamin C is, because C is water soluble. The magnesium can store. So you basically just keep increasing the dose on the magnesium until you get the person to the point where they're on the verge of diarrhea or they've gotten to the diarrhea and then they back off. So it's really good to just titrate slowly so you don't shoot them into diarrhea and end up with an irritated intestinal tract for a couple of days. Magnesium also promotes healthy methylation. And magnesium is lost really easily, so it needs to be constantly replenished. The good news about magnesium is you don't have to just take it orally. You can take it topically. You can get magnesium oil. You can put it in your bath, the magnesium oil. You can get it through Epsom salts in your bath, and it gets absorbed through your skin. There's a lot of ways to get the magnesium. Be creative. Play your person out, feel your person out, and see what way they're most likely to be compliant. Magnesium is a cofactor for CalmT. Remember we talked about CalmT in the beginning part. It's a methyl transferase enzyme that's really super important for estrogen metabolism as well as neurotransmitter function. So you have to make sure the person has enough magnesium in order for that CalmT to function adequately. Magnesium increases the influx and the outflux through the cells. So it helps with detoxification. It keeps the bowels moving, and people oftentimes use bowel tolerance doses of magnesium as a laxative. The deficiency symptoms of magnesium mimic menopausal symptoms and also high parathyroid symptoms. So if you've got a person who's younger and you don't really think that they should be going through menopause at this point, but they're having some menopausal symptoms, think magnesium, okay? Magnesium, like B6, is important for that excretion, the conjugation and excretion. So a person's magnesium needs might go up before their period. When I do taste testing for minerals, I find that I'll always tell a woman who's premenopausal, not even perimenopausal, but premenopausal, she's having periods. And maybe she's having PMS or dysmenorrhea or scanty periods or whatever. I'll have her test her magnesium during that week or two before her period. So starting at ovulation in the luteal phase of the cycle, I'll have her test, and then I'll have her test in the follicular phase. And most often it's decreased. in the follicular phase, which means that she shows more of magnesium deficiency signs and needs to be supplementing magnesium at that point. You can supplement magnesium as a powder. Magnesium glycinate is one of the best ones. Citrate can be irritating to the gut for some people who have irritable bowels, so glycinate would be better. There are other forms of magnesium that also are under relatively new, and research is being done on them. You don't want to do the oxide, magnesium oxide. That doesn't tend to be very well absorbed. Magnesium leads to muscle relaxation. So if you have somebody who's really tight, stiff, they complain about muscle spasms, they can't fall asleep because everything's tight, magnesium taken at bedtime can relax things and help people to sleep. Magnesium power foods, greens, chocolate, quinoa, almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, legumes, including soy and figs. High quantities of magnesium. If you eat a lot of greens and you get your people to eat the quantities of greens that I recommend, then they're going to be getting a lot of magnesium. But then you have to look at, are they absorbing enough? Like the other minerals, it's important to have good stomach acid in order to be able to absorb the magnesium. So you have to look at stomach acid, and when you're looking at stomach acid, you have to look at zinc status, because zinc is important for stomach acid. So you'll see that all these minerals and nutrients are in bed with each other. You have to be addressing the whole big picture. If you just take somebody and leave them on the standard American diet and throw a bunch of isolated nutrients at them, they may see some improvements, but you're not doing them a service, right? It's just balancing things so that you're getting a plethora of these nutrients in the food, and then you add whatever extras they need therapeutically for the state they are right at this moment. And then you constantly reevaluate that. I've spoken to people who are on the same supplement regime for 4 years. 4 years, that's a long time to be on the same supplement regime. So it needs to be reevaluated. It needs to be looked at. It needs to be looked at in terms of their symptomatology, their physical signs, and also their labs. And when you do that, you're going to be able to optimize their nutrients. Selenium, we've already studied in looking at thyroid function. It's important for the conversion from T4 to T3. It also protects estrogen functioning. It's important for some of the estrogen conversions. By keeping the ER alpha in check, right? Keeping the ER alpha from going out of control. And remember, the ER alpha, estrogen receptor alpha, is a type of receptor that when estrogen binds there, it causes growth. Enough growth is great, because growing breast tissue when you're going into puberty is great. Growing, replacing lung cells and replacing cells in your body, important. But when it goes out of control, cancer results. So you need the things that keep the ER alpha in check, and selenium is one of those. Selenium-rich foods. We all know about Brazil nuts. They're one of the most nutrient-dense sources, the most nutrient-dense source of selenium that we know of. Two Brazil nuts, only two nuts a day, contain the daily requirement. I don't know of any other food that you can eat two of and get your entire daily requirement. 400 micrograms a day, twice the daily requirement, has been found to be effective for Hashimoto's, for decreasing antibodies, and for thyroid receptor burnout, for restoring that, and for thyroid conversion issues. So when people have that therapeutic need, I'll usually have them on four Brazil nuts a day, or 400 micrograms a day. But if they're just doing for maintenance, just to keep everything healthy, I'll go for the two. Other foods that have higher levels of selenium that are not quite as good as Brazil nuts are sunflower seeds. And sunflower seeds also have lecithin, sunflower lecithin in it, which is a good source of the phospholipids, which are very protective. Lentils, cashews, and certain fishes like tuna and cod. So let's look at potassium. Potassium has an effect on insulin release and the response to glucose of the cells. So when you don't have enough potassium, it decreases your insulin release in response to glucose. Well, that might be a good thing, right? If you've got insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. On the other hand, for somebody who's diabetic, type 2, type 1 diabetic, that wouldn't be a good thing. So potassium is also important for optimal production of progesterone, by your ovary in response to LH. Remember luteinizing hormone? That's what gets secreted right at ovulation that causes the egg to be released. Okay? When you get the level of luteinizing hormone, it triggers your body to produce progesterone, so it starts to build up that lining. And potassium is important for that, and that's according to the Journal of Molecular Medicine. Here are some foods that are rich in potassium. Bananas, oranges, apricots, avocados, strawberries, potatoes, tomatoes, cucumber, cabbage, cauliflower. So a lot of people found that when they went on the B4B Gone diet and we took away some of their potatoes and bananas, which are high sources, they didn't know what else to do. So this is a list of foods that will give you like the what else to do when you go off of those other sources of potassium. And in the case where when you take people and put them on a low glycemic diet, if they start to get muscle cramps, oftentimes it's because they're not getting enough potassium-rich foods. So here's your list that you can share with them. Remember the aromatase enzyme that we talked about? Zinc inhibits the aromatase enzyme, and that promotes testosterone moving to estrogen. Okay, so more of the testosterone is going to go to estrogen, and that could be bad, especially if it goes to estrogen, and the estrogen, you don't have enough of the ER beta sites, and you're causing an estrogen dominance. Besides, a lot of women do tend to be low in testosterone, and certainly men don't want their testosterone going to estrogen any more than it should. So you want to make sure that you have enough zinc. Zinc's super important for aromatase. You also want to make sure that you have it because it helps to increase the progesterone levels and lower estrogen. And most people are estrogen dominant, and it's really helpful to have a higher ratio of progesterone, assuming they need that. It's important for growth hormone, which is super important for fat loss and lean muscle and repair. And it's important for repair of all your tissue and detox. And then finally, zinc affects thyroid levels, and it's critical to have proper zinc to have proper thyroid. Also, as I mentioned before, it's important for stomach acid. This is a small collection of important zinc actions. Zinc has hundreds of actions in the body. Important for the immune system as well. Skin, things like that. When you have too little zinc, you have a copper excess. It may not be that your copper is too high, but in relationship to zinc it is. And then you can get copper toxicity symptoms, and also the estrogen levels are affected by the copper. So here's just a list of some zinc-rich foods that you may not think about. And most of these are spices and herbs and flavorings, and they're quite high. I don't have the amounts on this particular slide, but I do have a chart which I will give you. It's a zinc chart that was taken out of the FDA database and then formatted in. And I have a section which is just the spices, because you can look and say, wow, I can get 5 milligrams of zinc by adding a teaspoon of paprika to my salad or to my thing. It helps you to be more creative with your spices when you're looking. And also in helping people, you go, you know what, if you just add some basil and dill to that salad dressing, you're going to get like 5 milligrams of zinc, which is 25% of your daily requirement. So depending on your age. So that's a good thing to know. And I'm going to get you that chart because it's a really good one. It was too big to fit on this page. Here's some things related to beans. I have a chart like this related to the spices. So some of the beans, adzuki, tempeh, which is soy, which is a bean. All of these beans have various amounts of zinc. Look at adzuki beans. A cup of adzuki beans cooked, not uncooked. A cup of cooked adzuki beans, 4 milligrams of zinc. That's quite substantial. And a lot of times you're told that if you're a vegetarian, you can't get enough zinc, you're going to be zinc deficient. But really, you can get quite a bit of zinc from your foods if you know where to look. And that's why I've given you these charts, because you're going to be coaching people into doing that. Zinc and nuts and seeds that are zinc rich. Look at sesame seeds. 1 ounce of sesame seeds, 2.9 an ounce of pumpkin seeds. So pumpkin seeds are always touted as really high in zinc, but in fact, sesame seeds are higher. And cashews are a good source. So if you're like me, I've been doing a lot of cashews recently because I've been doing cashew yogurt, and it's really easy to eat a lot of them. So it's good to know that I'm having a good amount of zinc in there. And the Brazil nuts. So if you're eating the 4 Brazil nuts, for the selenium, and I'm not sure just exactly how much those 4 weigh, but it's probably close to 1 ounce, you're also getting a fair amount of zinc as well. And then the sunflower seeds. So you see there's a lot of cross-population. If you get a fair amount of your seeds and some nuts, and then the vegetables and the sea vegetables, you're going to be packing in a good hearty punch with these minerals.
So some other nutrients, I just lumped them here because they don't really fit into vitamins, minerals, or macro. They're just other nutrients that are kind of not essential nutrients per se. Like, we can function without these and we can make these from other components, but it's oftentimes very important to take these, like NAC, N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine reduces DNA damage by the 4-series metabolites. Okay, so when you have a buildup of those 4-series, remember the 4-hydroxys, those are the most potent, the most dangerous. NAC, N-acetylcysteine, can help reduce the DNA damage caused by that. Okay, and cysteine is a sulfur-containing amino acid. Can you make this? Yes. Do you make it in efficient quantities? Maybe not if you're compromised. So it's something to recommend to people. I always recommend it when people are going through a detox and also when they're doing a gut repair, because it can be really important for that. NAC has also got a couple of other side benefits. Other side benefits related to mucus production. It thins the mucus. So people with lung stuff, it happens. SAMe, S-A-M capital and then a small e. That's a methyl donor. And again, with the whole methylation pathway, people who have MTHFR problems often benefit from SAMe, and it prevents the production of those nasty estrogen daughters, the 4s and the 16s. Okay? Calcium and calcium deglucarate especially helps to produce substances that assist in rinsing out the estrogens out of the body. Alpha-lipoic acid is another one. Alpha-lipoic acid actually helps to normalize cortisol levels and helps to potentiate insulin and lower blood sugar levels. So people who have insulin resistance and a lot of stress can be dealing with imbalances in alpha-lipoic acid. It also can act as a fill-in. If you don't have enough vitamin C or E, it can fill in as an antioxidant. It inhibits DNA damage that can come from those 4-series estrogen metabolites. Remember the OH4s that are the most damaging. And it inhibits the DNA damage from that. Also, we can make alpha-lipoic acid, but as we age, we're less able to make it. So when you take alpha-lipoic acid with T4, some studies have shown that it can decrease the conversion. Those are some things with alpha-lipoic acid. So everything is a double-edged sword. You have to just make sure that you don't blanketly say, oh, this is good, everybody should take it. So that's it for the foods.